Good evening. Good evening, everybody. Good evening.
Switch it on, David.
Yeah, I think it is on, actually, but thank you for that. First of all, welcome to this third debate. I think everybody knows the format. You've all ticked a box as you came in. And then you will also tick a box after the debate, and then we'll work out who's changed their mind after the debate. Now, each speaker will speak for about 7 to 10 minutes, 10 minutes maximum, and they'll make their points, and then the questions will come from the audience after that. There'll be a very brief summary from either side after that, while the votes are being counted. Now, finally, there will be the usual supper afterwards. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our speakers. First of all, say thank you very much for braving the traffic. I think it was a horrible journey. But on my right, Zahra is a graduate of Arab and Islamic Studies from SOS, which is part of the SOAS, which is part of the University of London. And I think you've lived in Egypt studying the Arabic language and now a researcher and international speaker for the Muslim Debate Initiative. And you're of Kurdish and Pakistani origin.
That's right.
I've got that right. You've delivered lectures at Nottingham, Sussex, Brighton, Lincoln, Southampton, Kiel, Bournemouth, Kent universities on the subjects of women in Islam, justice for women. And you've also spoken at numerous community centres and made regular media appearances on the Islam Channel, Muslim World, Voice of Russia, I noticed that. Good. And on my far right, Abdullah is an international speaker, thinker and intellectual activist for Islam and Muslim affairs. His work involves explaining and demonstrating by rational argument the intellectual proofs for the Islamic belief system and promoting the Islamic way of life and Islamic solutions for contemporary problems. Abdullah has delivered talks internationally and has spoken in community centres, universities, colleges, and numerous appearances on TV channels, including BBC, ITV, BBC Arabic, etc., etc. Welcome to you two. On my left-hand side, Adrian Page. I think most of us probably know Adrian, who's a leading QC and specializes in fact, the field of defamation and media law. My far left is a retired judge who subsidizes his hobbies of cycling with mediation advice. A man of vision and all-round experience, I hope. So, without further ado, I'd like to ask Zahra if you would like to start. You can stand up or sit down.
Hey, good evening, everyone. I greet you all with the Islamic greeting of peace, which is Assalamu Alaikum, and that means may the peace and blessings of God be upon you all. First of all, thank you all for attending, and thank you to the organisers for their invitation and their gracious hospitality in getting us here this evening, eventually. So to begin, the motion for this debate this evening is Sharia law fairer than English law? And it's no doubt a somewhat confrontational motion. The term Sharia law, for one, has been deeply misrepresented by popular culture, populist demagogues, politicians deflecting blame for foreign policies, and also by the selective, sensationalist, and the somewhat exaggerated reporting of the media, which has created many of the deeply entrenched but false misconceptions about the Sharia that we see today. And attempting to undo decades of this misrepresentation and the oversimplification of the Sharia in the short time allotted today will be somewhat of a challenge, especially in the presence of an opposing side with an equal amount of time. So I would simply ask you today to keep an open mind and, like in any court, judge solely on what you hear substantiated here today and not necessarily on what you've heard outside. An important message before we begin is that we are not here debating whether the UK should be under Sharia law, nor are we debating whether you, as a matter of taste, feel or find that the Sharia law is preferable to English law or vice versa. The simple question is whether Sharia itself is fairer than English law. That's all. It could be, for example, that something is fairer but not quite to your liking. So, for example, one may believe that a purely meritocratic or a purely egalitarian society is fairer than the other, but you may still have a preference for one over the other. So likewise, I would call upon you to consider today's motion in very much the same way. And so, first of all, fairness. The motion is based on the idea of fairness, so the question that arises is, what is fairness and how do you define this? Islam posits that fairness is, firstly, the equality of treating identical things equally, second, being consistent in that, and third, giving what is deserved, and what is deserved must address the human nature correctly. The first misconception that I'd like to address this evening is the idea that the Muslim world today somehow exemplifies the Sharia. This is false. The Muslim world today is, in fact, as we know, a post-colonial creation that's defined and delineated by other states, fashioned from borrowed Western concepts of the nation-state and secularism, and given so-called independence once a client ruler was established. Now, 2 centuries of such Western colonialism have completely disrupted and completely abolished centuries of continuous, enlightened Islamic thought and jurisprudence, leaving populations politically illiterate and possessing only a rudimentary understanding of Sharia. And they live under secular regimes which restrict and which control Islamic scholarship, and at best, they often misapply token aspects of Sharia law simply to placate the populations. Now, where once they were ruled by principle and by wisdom of the Sharia, they became ruled purely by power and brute force, with conflicting interest groups becoming embroiled in fighting for self-interest and essentially for privilege. And when those post-colonial governments are toppled, this political illiteracy and lack of understanding of the actual Sharia causes the rise of Islamic movements and different vigilante and militia-style forms of dealing with each other. And it's this that leads to the injustices that the media selectively reports on. It's the equivalent, if you can imagine, to the UK being colonised by a foreign power for 100 years, having all education of English law removed from teaching, and the collapse of the English government, along with all traditional institutions. And after 100 years, all that would remain is a shallow understanding of the English law. Vigilantes ruled by warlords would be subject to frenzy, to zealotry and hysteria, and dole out harsh punishments and harsh sentences upon the slightest suspicion of guilt. Anyone merely accused of a certain crime would be unfairly judged and extremely harshly punished. And no doubt the media of the foreign power that had colonized Britain would then selectively report on those injustices that occur and say that English law is barbaric, English law is unfair and harsh. So myself or my colleague today do not seek to explain some form of modernized or reformed Sharia, and nor do we seem to explain how it is acted out in the current Muslim world. Rather, we hope to present to you for your deliberation the true face of the Sharia as it was taught and practiced by the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, peace be upon him, and practiced in the courts by an entire civilization for over 1400 years that once brought peace, enlightenment, and coexistence to a previously benighted region. So, what is the Sharia? The purpose of the Sharia is essentially to provide for the fulfillment of human nature, its proclivities and tendencies, to protect the weak from the strong, and to create an environment that's conducive to virtue and good conduct in the public sphere, whilst allowing an unimpinged free agency within the private sphere. Rightly, it does not conceive the human nature as being individualistic. Rather, with regards to human beings, it perceives them as being social beings, imbued with free will, and that they are created for a higher purpose other than the simple, base, narcissistic self-interest. And in its courts, Sharia has features such as habeas corpus, the right to a fair trial, innocent until proven guilty, case law and precedent, testimony, and the need for evidence. Now, Sharia law is not a totalitarian system, and you may be surprised at how laissez-faire it actually is. For example, in the autonomy of families, in the fact that it holds no barred intellectual discourse and debate, including criticism of Islam. There is no jurisdiction under the Sharia to spy or interfere into household privacy, something that English law doesn't entirely respect. No interference in private worship of individuals. There's less regulation in the free market. And the Sharia law is essentially fairer than English law because it is not opposed on minorities who hold different worldviews. So the Sharia only applies to Muslims and it does not apply to non-Muslims. This is because the Sharia believes that it's not fair, it doesn't make sense for non-Muslims to be subject to a law that they do not believe in. Now, unlike in English law, Islam historically was fair to its minorities by not expecting them to be subject to the majority's law or to the law of a small minority of corporate influence politicians. Non-Muslims, instead, were given their own courts and their own freely accessible areas or quarters where they had autonomous jurisdiction to freely exercise their own community and build their own environment to their pleasing. And this was how Islam fairly treated its minorities, by giving them their own cultural and legal space, and even their own judges and their own law enforcement. Such was the fairness and justice that the famous historian Richard Bouillier notes in his book, The Case for Islamo-Christian Civilization. Minutely studying case after case, they have shown that justice was generally meted out impartially, irrespective of religion, official status, and gender. Not being subject to the Sharia, Jews and Christians were free to go to their own religious authorities for the adjudication of disputes. So these all point to the fact that the Sharia is not a totalitarian system, whereas the English system is a little different in that regard. Next, the Sharia is fairer to married men and married women than English law is. First of all, in the Sharia, women are granted fundamental equality in the Quran. So God says, "I do not waste the deed of any among you, be they male or female. The one of you is as the other." And so in Sharia, although both Sharia and English law agree that both men and women have the right to consent to marriage, due to the concepts of individualism, English law doesn't really provide critical rights that either can expect from their marriage partner, save for a few legal roles and powers that could easily be replicated by other legal techniques like trusts, powers of attorney, and so forth. The Sharia, on the other hand, is fairer because it gives women and men the rights to have their human needs fulfilled by their spouses. For both husband and wife, a Sharia marriage constitutes the following: the right to respect, affection, and time from their spouse, whereas the English law does not really, like, even strictly prohibit husbands from casually insulting their wives or vice versa. They also have the right to settle sexual satisfaction from their spouse, which is a pre-agreement for both parties, which either party can withdraw by simply initiating a divorce. And thirdly, the right to divorce, which is quicker and faster than the divorces in the UK because it only really requires one meeting with a minor judge if necessary. The wife in particular has certain rights which suit her proclivities. So, for example, she has the right to shelter provided by her husband, the right to food and clothing that is equal in quality to that of her husband's, the right to physical protection provided by her husband. She has the right to a dowry, and she has the ability to divorce without being unfairly left without adequate position, i.e. she has the right to alimony. A man once asked the Prophet, "What do you say about our wives?" And the Prophet, peace be upon him, replied, "Give them food from what you have for yourself and clothe them by that which you clothe yourself. Do not beat them and do not insult them." The husband in particular also has certain rights, the right to access to his children. It's not fair that English law permits sex outside marriage and yet it provides women with an automatic right to her children, regardless of whether she's married or not, but imposes a financial obligation on men to pay child support while sometimes denying them a necessary right to a relationship with their biological children. In effect, it is a tax without representation, which is completely unfair. It also provides the husband the ability to divorce as with the woman, but without being unfairly deprived of ownership of property or assets, which is more likely in English divorce courts. Next, the Sharia law is fairer than English law because it shows more mercy. Whilst English law demands its pound of flesh, the Sharia law shows mercy and it encourages forgiveness. So the Sharia is fairer than English law because, for example, it shows mercy to weak humans, so it doesn't punish poor people who have to steal to feed themselves for all their families. That's considered the fault of the state if someone is so poor that they are forced to steal. Sharia also better protects men from some false accusations of rape by simply prohibiting the consumption of alcohol, leaving no related confusion with regards to consent. English law is also less fair to men in some respects because it supports the traditional understanding of rape, but it is defined exclusively by use of the male genitalia, which effectively means that women are not prosecutable for rape, despite directly raping someone, but merely for sexual assault. This is unfair. Finally, Sharia is fairer to victims and also to victims' families than English law is. So, for example, the Sharia doesn't punish by putting criminals into cages like human zoos. Rather, it provides either like-for-like retribution for bodily harms, including capital punishment and murder. Thus, if a successful conviction is obtained, it lets the family of the victim decide whether to punish or whether to forgive and demand pecuniary compensation instead. And I'll end with a quote, which is by a gentleman who was in the news recently, known as John Clough. And maybe this was a couple of years ago. His daughter was murdered by her bodybuilder former partner. And he said this about the Sharia. This was a man grieving for his daughter after she had been murdered. "Our daughter Jane was murdered by her ex-partner. We don't believe Jane received justice for the crimes he committed against her. In Sharia law, in the case of premeditated murder, the judge does not pass the sentence. It is given to the victim's family and they can choose to have retribution, execution, or they can have blood money paid. They can even choose to forgive. Had the decision been there to have him executed or sent to prison, I would have built the gallows, I would have carried out the deed myself. The Sharia system that gives the victim's family some input is worthy of consideration. For me, for Penny, for my family to have some say in the punishment factor in the crimes he committed against Jane would have given us some satisfaction." And on that note, I ask you today to vote in favour of the motion that having the qualities of treating identical things equally, being consistent, and giving what is deserved in accordance with human nature, Sharia law is indeed fairer than English law. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you very much, Zara. I'd now like to ask Andrea to respond.
Well, we've heard from Zaria one interpretation of Sharia. It's not a universal interpretation, nor is it by any means universally practiced. You have to look wider. You have to look at the framework within which law is determined, declared, and administered. And that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to start with four facts about the common law. These are facts which I believe differentiate a common law system from Sharia. I'm then going to explain why I believe that facing up to these differences is of great current importance in our society, differences which I believe have not been addressed in any way so far. I start with my four facts, but by way of preface, I acknowledge that no system of justice can achieve perfection. There are many inadequacies in the common law system, and these can result in injustice and harm. But this evening's debate is about comparing legal systems. My first fact is this, that God has no role in the common law. Any reliance upon the word of God to determine legal rights was removed from our legal system almost 800 years ago. That is when, in one of the great reforms of Magna Carta, trial by ordeal was replaced with trial by jury. We now have guilt or innocence of a serious crime decided by the verdict of 12 men and women, our contemporaries. Under trial by ordeal, you would be exposed to some barbaric ritual whereby only a miracle could save you from death or serious injury. The belief was that if the miracle was performed, that was God's verdict upon your innocence. If you were guilty, God condemned you to your horrific fate. So which would you prefer, the secular legal system of the common law, or a system in which extremist communities can continue to defend barbaric ritual as the true interpretation of God's law. My second fact is this: the common law is the law common to all members of society. The common law system of justice is a unified legal system. That is to say, the same law and the same interpretation of the law applies across the land to every member of society. The fundamental principle is one law for all, irrespective of gender, irrespective of race, irrespective of religion. No man can pick and choose from amongst different schools of interpretation which legal regime they want to govern their relations with their wives or children. There is no spectrum of legal interpretation from which you can select that which allows you precedence over your wife. The common law is administered by a single body of judges comprising a hierarchy of decision makers from the magistrates' court right up to the Supreme Court. The head of this country's family of courts recently declared, "Our judges sit as secular judges serving a multicultural community of many faiths, sworn to do justice to all manner of people." The judges in a common law system are centrally selected for the qualities of their intellect, impartiality, independence, and other than lay magistrates, for their experience in the common law. In a common law system, unless appointed a judge, you cannot exercise judicial authority, nor can your community or your church or your mosque grant you authority to exercise judicial power. So no matter how learned you are in the interpretation of ancient texts, no matter how revered you are within your community for your wisdom or your holiness, you cannot issue legally binding rulings that determine guilt or innocence of a crime, nor can you ordain what punishment will fit the crime. You cannot issue rulings determining anyone's civil legal rights and obligations, whether it be as between citizen and state, as between citizen and citizen, as between husband and wife, or as between parent and child. In the common law system, judicial authority is exclusively vested in the judges. So which would you prefer? The system of the common law with its centralized body of judges, or a decentralized system in which a religious leader in one country could, by fatwa, declare it the duty of all Muslims to execute the subject of another country? Remember Salman Rushdie at the hands of Ayatollah Khomeini. And now my third fact, which is this: that our techniques of lawmaking enable the common law to evolve and adapt over time. The common law is evolved by the judges through a process of careful logical reasoning. Legal principles are abstracted from the facts of concrete cases as they are decided. No decided case is set in stone so as to have permanent legal effect. Rather, each decided case is a foundation upon which future legal development may be built. Our body of case law forms a bedrock of principle against which new situations can be tested. By this means, the law is constantly being reviewed, adjusted, and refreshed to keep it attuned to the society which it serves. If inconsistencies arise between decisions on similar facts, they are eliminated by a system of appeals. This is in contrast to Islam, in which the basic Sharia laws are open to authoritative interpretations which are radically conflicting. So which would you prefer? The common law system, in which the law is a living and evolving organism, or a system in which the law was declared in ancient times and which now can only evolve so far as its ancient roots can be stretched without snapping? And now my fourth and last fact: that open justice is a core principle of the common law. It is an underlying core principle of English law that all court hearings are open to the public. Court orders and court judgments are given in public, never behind closed doors. As a general rule, it is only in exceptional circumstances that the court permits any relaxation of that fundamental principle, An example may be where publicity would take away the privacy of a vulnerable child. In this digital era, you can watch live on your electronic devices the proceedings of the United Kingdom Supreme Court. You can also watch electronically some of the proceedings of the Court of Appeal. Why is open justice such a valuable principle? For many reasons. Chief amongst them are that the public nature of court proceedings deters inappropriate behaviour on the part of the court. It also maintains the public's confidence that impartial and fair justice takes place. So which would you prefer? The system in which justice is administered in the presence of the public, or the system in which legal rules and legal decisions can be made behind closed doors, with none of the safeguards of transparency and accountability? Now, those are just four unanswerable reasons why Sharia law is not fairer than the common law. Finally, a few words on why we need this debate at all in this country and today. The answer is that we already have in this country a rapidly developing parallel quasi-legal system. It has been estimated that there are at least 85 Sharia courts or councils in the United Kingdom. Research suggests that they keep little in the way of records and that they provide no right of appeal. There is no system of control over who serves on these bodies or on how they are conducted, such as applies in our secular courts. Their supposed purpose is the informal resolution of disputes, mediation. However, much evidence has been collected that many Muslim women believe and are allowed to believe that these informal tribunals are real courts. They therefore submit to rulings based on inherently discriminatory principles. The women who so submit are either not aware that they have civil legal rights in this country, which guarantees them equal treatment with men, or they are subject to family and community pressures not to seek their rights outside their community. Only through our commitment to the common law, as the only system of justice in this country, can we protect and preserve the very foundation of our society, which is equality of treatment under the law.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Adrian. Abdullah?
I too greet you all with the Islamic greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum. May the peace and blessing of God be upon you all. I first want to address, I think there was a straight set of straw man and misunderstanding about the Sharia law. And I'm going to only talk about the Sharia law, which is commonly agreed amongst Muslim jurists, not convenient interpretations and so on. First and foremost, that God has no role in common law, and this was abolished 800 years. But only recently was the blasphemy law abolished. And I think you'll find that God does have a role, even in English law, when under statute law, I believe, all educational institutions, or basically schools, have to have majority Christian assemblies and have to apply for an exception from that rule. So you still have Christianity part and parcel of English law. So it looks like you haven't got rid of God entirely just yet. Then he talked about, well, either it's trial, you know, by a judge or trial by ordeal. As these were the only two options, so what? So then the only other option is that you blanket the rest of the world as, or they do things by trial by ordeal. We don't do that. I think that's really, that's just blatantly wrong, and maybe possibly disingenuous in the matter, because trial by ordeal, this was European medieval history. This was something that happened. It was very European. We never, ever had trial by ordeal in 1,400 years. I would like to challenge my colleague to bring just one example where Muslim courts, throughout any period of our Muslim history, has used trial by ordeal. You'll not find it. It was trial by a judge, or judges. And the Maliki school believes in trial by jury too. Some people say that might have actually entered into the English legal system via Sicily, but that's I'll leave that for historians to discuss that idea. Then it's posited that, you know, common law is one law for all members. Isn't that fair? Well, it would be fair if everyone was homogenous, if everyone thought exactly the same and everyone had exactly the same background and ideas and beliefs of what is good and bad. But the problem is, is that you are ignoring human differences, or rather differences of communities. Different communities have different sets of ideals. Now, maybe when before immigration, England was roughly homogenous, more or less. Maybe there was some Catholics and Protestants and many other issues like this. But when you could say maybe a roughly homogenous Christian background, maybe this would have made more sense. However, in the modern world, well, not in the modern world, even in medieval times, in the Islamic caliphates, we had Christian communities, we had Jewish communities. And we didn't believe that, oh, Sharia is one law for all, that's fair, because it wouldn't be fair, because people disagree as to what is right or wrong. In fact, it actually would be intolerant. I mean, even communists and Stalinists believed in one law for all, their law on everybody. Like everyone, this uniform object that you can just put through the same hole. That's not how humans work. That's not how different communities and societies worked. I guess just give you an example. I mean, just look at the values, right? There is no reason why in English law, let's say, that polygamy should be banned. If gay marriage is allowed in English law, and it's because of consent is the basis for allowing it, then surely is not shouldn't consent also allow polygamy? But it's purely because of maybe a cultural tradition or perhaps certain prejudices that they allow one and not allow the other. Why couldn't you allow polygamy, for example, if it was done by consenting adults? And it's not only referring to Muslims here, it could also be referring to Mormons and many other people, and Jews who also believe in that prayer, and some Christians as well. It was also mentioned by my colleague that said judges must be competent and objective. I agree, we have the same. Why is that only specifically in English law? I'm pretty sure that in most countries, judges are meant to be competent and objective. You might have many bad apple judges, but surely there is a system in most countries and in most legal systems, both Jewish, Islamic, even in Hindu Dharmic religions, where the judge has to be objective and fair. I think that's being disingenuous again, I would have to say. What is the basis for law? It's not religious texts. It's the judges. No, they're not the basis for law. It's a bunch of self-interested politicians who decide what laws be enacted, and they might be governed by other interests than just the public will or what the public desire. So, and the problem is this. Now, this might make things subjective, because There are problems, as Immanuel Kant and Thomas Jefferson has noted, about the problems with democracy. Maybe the majority can cause trouble if they succumb to hysteria, and you have to control this. At the same time, of course, if you have an oligarchy of just a limited number of people deciding laws for everybody else, that's also an imposition. How do you solve this problem? There is no real solution for imposition. Some humans are going to be imposing on others in most law systems. But at least what we try to offer is that for Muslims who believe in Islam, they have a system that comes from their values, and we don't impose it on Jews and Christians. At the very least, that is fairer than the alternative. It was also said that law can adapt over time. Well, of course, all laws adapt over time depending on the situation. So, for example, even with Islamic civilization, even with Islam and Sharia, if we think something is a substance is harmless, it's not banned. But if it becomes apparent that it's a drug and it becomes addictive and it's harmful, then that becomes banned. Much like any most other legal systems, there's a huge aspect of reasoning and observation of the natural world to come to understandings and to adapt accordingly. But the thing is this, there are aspects in most legal systems, I should hope, which should never be changing, such as rape being illegal, murder being illegal. These things are unchanging, hopefully, and they shouldn't change. There are certain constants which should never change in any legal system. The only debate is, what are these constants? That's the only discussion here. And I posit that without any higher epistemological framework other than human convenience, you don't have a justification basis for why you should implement any of these laws. The origins of English law used to have that, but now not so much. There's also discussions about the courts are open to the public. And of course, so Islamic courts are open to the public throughout history of how we discharged the work from the many sources. If you look at our history, all courts were public. Unfortunately, the English law, there are aspects whereby the government can have secret hearings, especially what they call for evidence which is obtained by intelligence services. But this is the problem, because then how do you stop political dissenters from being given an unfair trial which is not subject to public scrutiny by just claiming, oh, it's sensitive intelligence information which we can't share with the public, but you just have to accept our word for it that they're getting a fair trial. Well, I'm sorry, I don't have that much faith in the government, as perhaps my colleague does. And then there's a discussion of there's these quasi-legal systems arising in England. Which one? Are you also going to include and criticise the Beit Din, which the Jewish community operate in the UK? Is that also a problem that we have to address and suppress? I would say that English law, I mean, I said no one here is arguing for the deposition or the deposing English law. What we're saying is that in aspects where English law says it's up to the people to decide maybe how to resolve their situation through arbitration, it's their choice whether they're atheists, whether they're Hindus, Muslims, Jews, whatever you want to choose, if you can resolve amongst yourselves, do so. In this aspect, Muslims make the free choice to resolve some of their conflicts via the Sharia law. It shouldn't make no difference whether they are Muslim or not, because they should have the free choice in aspects where the English law has not said anything, said it's up to you. So to say that this is a problem is, again, very worrying intolerance. But now just going on to a bit more about Sharia law, and I said there's a lot of misconceptions, but we're going to go through all of them, hopefully, steadily. One of the biggest injustices that Sharia law recognizes is exploitation of the poor, and in that basis we ban interest banking. Now, even though people might consent to engage in interest banking, but having an entire economic system dominated by interest banking, dominated by mortgages, ultimately the net flow of wealth will go from the poor to the rich, causing a mass concentration of wealth. And so we protect the poor by negating any contracts which exploit them. Likewise, with a mortgage where, for example, if you're making payments on your house and you default, the bank not only can repossess your house, but keep all the money that you've paid. Under Islam, we consider it to be an incomplete contract. When you give someone money, they have to give you a product or service in return. If they have not delivered that to you, then it's incomplete and they must return to you your money. And this is very unfair. We also view that as unfair as the printing of fiat currency, which basically devalues everyone's wealth, by a private corporation, which is the Bank of England. It's not a national bank, it's not owned by the government, it's a private company, much like the Federal Reserve Bank, which isn't really federal. Fractional reserve banking, and also the problem of monopolies of key foodstuffs and things that people depend on. The Sharia law bans these things to protect the poorest, the weakest, and the most vulnerable. It also grants ownership of public resources to the people, not private energy companies. And of course, in the modern world, this could take the form of people being charged merely extraction price for their gas, electricity, and so on. And obviously given for free for the elderly who can't afford it. And in the current English system, unfortunately, many of them have to choose between eating or heating, which is some of the problems that face many of the poor today, unfortunately. So the Sharia, I would argue, is fairer because it looks after the interests of the poor, it prevents their exploitation, but it also allows free market, because instead of having all these types of interest banking and mortgage, and then having to have all these types of regulations because of abuses and so much, and various financial institutions, Islam says these forms of contracts are illegal and exploitative. After that, you can do what you want and engage in any contract you want and go forth and multiply your wealth and invest and so on and so forth. So Islam actually has less regulation and less need of regulatory bodies because it has already invalidated the worst and most exploitative contracts which unfairly target the poor. I would also like to say that in Sharia there is multiple interpretations, because all texts are subject to interpretation, and that's fine, and that's perfectly healthy. So maybe in English law, the judges don't refer to the Quran or to the Bible, they refer to a very large corpus of quite sometimes contradictory text, statute law and common law. There's actually quite a lot of text there. Lawyers and judges have to sift through, and a lot of these times they clash. Many of these laws and ideas, they clash, and you have to find a balance, you have to find a way of interpretation and so on and so forth. This is just a human reality. You can't say, oh, Sharia law suffers from that problem and we don't suffer from that problem. No, all human jurisprudence suffers from that problem. And the issue is not a choice between judges and religious leaders. I think that's perhaps insulting. They're not religious leaders, they actually are jurisprudence. I'm not talking to, we don't have a clergy by any, but just to clarify, we don't have a priestly caste. We have people who study law and then become qualified jurisprudence. Last time I checked in the English system, education system, you had the same method. So it's not really nice to say that these are not jurisprudence, they're religious leaders. No, they're not religious leaders, they're jurisprudence. And their ideas or their interpretations can be binding or not, depending on whether they are employed by the state in the position of judge. If they don't have a position of judge, they can't offer a legally binding ruling, which is like English law. So just to clarify some misconceptions. I'd also like to say that in Islam, just to clarify something, there is freedom of expression in intellectual discourse. So you can criticize, you can debate absolutely anything for intellectual purposes. The only thing that Islam prohibits is insult. So to insult anyone's faith, and it prohibits Muslims from insulting Hindus and Jews and Christians and atheists. So we're not allowed to insult anyone, because that's not how human respect is built on. It's not built on insulting people's beliefs. What defines them? One could argue that your beliefs, your worldview, defines you more than the color of your skin and your sexual preference. Yet, the color of your skin and sexual preference has more protections in English law than a person's worldview. And I said there's a difference between insult and critique. Everyone knows what insult means. If I was to say that all Muslims are evil and barbaric, that's insult. If I was to say I believe that Christianity has some irrational conceptions of God, that's intellectual critique. It's not, there is a difference between the two. Sharia recognizes it, and you had great debates in even medieval Baghdad between atheists and one of our famous scholars called Imam Abu Hanifa. Very famously reported ones. We had books which were entitled Methods of Refutation of Muslims, Muslim Theology, published in Antioch, Islamic Antioch, by Christians in the, I believe it was the 11th century. So Christians, Jews, atheists weren't restricted from criticizing Islam as long as it was intellectual and for the purposes of advancement of knowledge and truth. And this is what Islam offers. And it offers, and it considers the protection of people's beliefs to be more sacrosanct than the protection of just your skin color or your sexual preference, which really don't define you as a person more than your actual worldview does. Thank you.
Thank you, Abdullah, for that speedy lecture. Tim.
I don't like to, when I talk, I like to see the people I'm talking to. I grew up in a middle-class home with a powerful mother and two older sisters, and that engendered in me a certain knowledge that women were the more powerful gender. My father was a quiet, avuncular man who had been through Dunkirk, El Alamein, and Monte Cassino and just wanted a quiet life. My grandmother, whom we visited a lot, lived near Aldershot and was a British Army widow. My grandfather had died in Quetta in 1934. All up her staircase, there were photographs of posed Pathan warriors holding 303s. My grandmother and her friends would make curries at her home, the house had a touch of the exotic about it to me. Never in all my visits did I ever encounter any racism, only regret for good old days. Indeed, my aunt, the youngest of the family, told me when she was 85 that her first language had been Urdu. I was astonished at 18 to discover that women were treated as second-class citizens, and if you were from an ethnic minority background in this country, you were treated even worse. And to cut a long story short, I spent a long time in my life within the limitations of being a white middle-class male in trying in a small sort of way to fight against those twin injustices that existed for women and ethnic minorities. So I started my life as a barrister career, then gave that up and worked for Save the Children for 12 years, and then went back to being a barrister afterwards. And coincidentally, one stage I ended up in Pakistan, where I spent the best part of 4 years, sometimes accompanied by my wife and baby daughter. Now, how does this link to the motion this House believes that Sharia law is fairer than common law? Well, I can't compete with the academic brains of Abdullah and Zahra and Adrienne. Superb presentations, all of them. But I can only offer a few thoughts from the perspective of an old barrister and an aid worker. And the first thing to say is that clearly Sharia law is imposed in different countries in entirely different ways, from the softer liberal approach taken in Indonesia to the hard line, cut your hand off for theft and stone you to death for alleged adultery in Saudi Arabia and Iran. Secondly, I do not believe in a God, but I have enormous respect for those who do. And on a daily basis in Pakistan and Sudan, where I also worked and experienced the jails as an inmate, I witnessed the enormous kindnesses which my colleagues' faith ordered them to carry out. My Muslim colleagues, my friends, they looked after me. I owe my life. It's not too strong to say I owe my life to my Muslim friends and work colleagues from both those countries. But the point is, I'm not a believer, and in this country, I'm allowed not to be a believer with its liberal traditions. We now live in a largely secular country with laws derived from the common law system. Now, I don't want to rely on a religion for the interpretation of those laws. Remember the Inquisition and women being burned at the stake if they had a touch of the mystic meg about them. I want us to derive our laws from a humane approach to justice which Parliament lays down at any one time, which is interpreted by the judges, and which reflects the kinder aspects of our society. Remember, we abolished capital punishment before many countries, and probably against the will of a narrow majority of our people. But I believe it to have been the right thing to do, and so did the old judges who used to administer the capital punishment. They were wholly in favour of the abolition of it, because they knew that in fact miscarriages of justice could take place. There is no place in our modern society, for all its ills, for a system which derives from a man, with great respect, from 1500 years ago, and interpreted through hadiths down the centuries, delivered right up to the present day by men. At least we have some women in our parliament, and we have some women judges. And what, for example, would Sharia law, I wonder, say about gay marriage? I happen not to be gay, but I take delight in the ability of my gay friends to celebrate their relationships and to have that relationship enshrined in law with all the concomitant protections. Now, Zahra is the expert here on Islamic feminism, and I respect that absolutely. All I know is, as a family law practitioner, that women suffer inequality compared to men in the Sharia courts in the UK. Islamic courts meet every week in the UK to rule on divorces and financial disputes. Remember this, the testimony of a woman is only held to be half of the testimony of a man in these Sharia courts. But it's not my observations that matter. Look at what the Iranian and Kurdish women's rights organization have said. By allowing the operation of Sharia family law in the name of multiculturalism, Muslim women are victimized and left to suffer. When I was in Pakistan, there was much debate over the Hadood ordinances, which, according to its supporters, were divinely revealed. In short, if a woman complained of rape, it had to be proved by 4 Muslim adult male witnesses who had to give eyewitness evidence of the act of penetration. Clearly, as you can imagine, this was almost impossible to achieve. And without that evidence, then the woman was clearly guilty of fornication or adultery because she had stated that sexual intercourse had taken place, and that would result in either imprisonment or a whipping, or both. President Musharraf replaced those offences with the Woman Protection Act 2006, but those reforms have come under considerable opposition from Islamist groups in Pakistan who insist that the law should follow the Sharia. Yet when that Sharia law was in place in Pakistan, 80% of women in jail in 2003 were there because they had failed to prove rape charges and were consequently convicted of adultery. What is fair about that? Furthermore, in 2006, when I was working in Pakistan for Save the Children, I had an appointment with an incredibly brave group of Pakistani women lawyers, all Muslims, who ran a non-profit organization for women, which offered legal advice and a refuge. 1 week before I went there, their offices had been attacked by a mob and their security guard had been killed. The perpetrators were Islamic fundamentalists. Now, the actions against these lawyers would, I have no doubt, be utterly condemned by my friends on the right, totally. But it raises an important and fundamental point, and this is it. It is my contention that any law has to be seen within the context of what sort of environment the philosophy of that law creates. It can be said with justification that Sharia law, in its purest form, is fair and rooted in a mechanism that helps to oil the wheels of society within a moral framework based on the teachings of the Prophet. But how is it perceived and how is it implemented? Of course, a few countries implementing Sharia law, I say a few only, carry out draconian and barbaric sentences. But the perception and interpretation of Sharia in those countries allows and commands them to do so. That interpretation is not far from home. One of the leading advocates of Sharia law in this country has stated, you only need to cut off one thief's hand and stone one woman to death and the offences would cease. The job of the police, the job of the British police, would be much easier, he said. If you share that belief, my friends, vote in favour of the motion. If, however, you value the great traditions of tolerance and compassion that this country espouses, for all its frailties, then you have to look at the mechanism for implementing that tolerance and compassion. And where does it come from? The English common law. You may belong to that group that gets irritated when people talk about human rights and see the hidden hand of the European Union behind these hidden rights. But may I remind you that rights were an integral part of Roman law, and our own civil war was fought entirely over the concept of rights for the ordinary man. Rights for the ordinary woman had to wait a few hundred years. It was English politicians led by Churchill that fought for the European Convention on Human Rights to be set up in 1950. Based on the freedoms enshrined in English common law. In summary, it simply does not matter to the person going to law for redress how fair that law is as it appears in its written form. The only thing that matters is how it is interpreted and how it is implemented. And I'm afraid that there are too many examples of Sharia law being interpreted and implemented in a way which is unfair to women, unfair to those from a different religion, and unfair to the vulnerable. I turn to the obituary of Lord Denning as given by Lord Gough, because he puts it far better than I can. Lord Gough said of Lord Denning, "He taught us all that if justice was to be done, the common law could not stand still. It must be developed to respond to the demands of justice in a living society." A living society, my friends, not a society based on what might have been appropriate for Arabia 1500 years ago. I invite you to vote against the motion.
Thank you, Tim. Zara, I wonder whether you'd like to respond.
Yes.
For a few moments, please.
Okay, I have maybe five or six points to respond to, which were brought up by both Adrian and Tim on my left. The first was, in my presentation, I made quite clear that we were not talking about Sharia as it's applied in the current Muslim world. And the reason for this I explained also very clearly. The practice of Sharia that we see in the Muslim world today is not reflective of the historical, wisely practiced Sharia that we've had up until as recently as only 80 years ago, which was when the last caliphate was finally abolished. And so when we keep turning to examples of how the Sharia is practiced in the Muslim world today, as I mentioned earlier, we're turning to the kind of very barbaric and very uninformed and declined forms of thinking and declined forms of practice. And so examples of the Sharia as it's enacted in those countries today is not a relevant argument for why the Sharia and its body of law is itself unfair. And in fact, I don't think I heard even one substantial sort of piece of evidence about what the Sharia actually says. All we've rather heard is how the Sharia is being enacted in the Muslim world today. And so I don't think that any kind of real claims have been made about the Sharia by the opposition today. And just to sort of point out, the way that the Sharia works is that it is a comprehensive, wholesome system. In order for the law to be accurate and in order for it to be implemented properly, it requires a full infrastructure. So I mentioned a few moments ago about how the last system we had in which it was properly implemented was the Ottoman Caliphate. And just one example from that, because Adrian also mentioned that if women knew that they had access to common law, they would, you know, perhaps jump at it rather than Sharia law. In the Ottoman Caliphate, up until the 1900s, women, not only Muslim women, but women of other religions who had access to their own religious courts would prefer Islamic courts because they were fairer and more just to the needs of women. So those women of Armenian background, Christian background, Jewish background, they had access to their own courts, as I discussed earlier, and yet they preferred Islamic courts because they were more understanding of their needs. So to say that Muslim women would prefer English law or common law if they knew what the options were, it's not reflective of reality. Secondly, the claim was made that English law changes. The fact that something changes is not inherently evidence that it is fair. It doesn't demonstrate fairness, and it doesn't demonstrate that it can be fair. The ability to change has nothing to do with fairness, and in fact, it also makes it susceptible to change according to swaying majorities and absolute hysteria. Doesn't necessarily lead to fairness, and doesn't necessarily lead to justice. Just a few more points that came up in the last presentation. It was mentioned that women were burnt at the stake, as if to juxtapose that this is opposite to what that we have today in the modern world, and as if to say that this might be where the Sharia would lead to, or it might be more connected with the Sharia somehow. Women being burnt at the stake is not our history. This is European history, and so to bring this up is a very sort of Eurocentric argument or comment to make, and it doesn't really serve the motion that English law is somehow fairer than Sharia law. I don't really see the link. The other point raised was in admiration of gay marriage. Well, Islamic law went even a step further than gay marriage. It recognized the practice of the Zoroastrians, who had practiced called self-marriage, but it was effectively incest. It did not interfere in their right to do so. And so just to say, oh, gay marriage is great, well, Islamic law has been more accommodating than that. And as my colleague mentioned earlier, if English law is so accommodating as to, appreciate and value the institute of gay marriage, why not polygamous marriage as well? Finally, there was a point raised about rape accusations and how it's required for there to be four witnesses to this. This is incorrect. This is actually the evidential burden for adultery or other types of fornication. The evidential burden is four witnesses. The reason for that is because it's very hard to have four witnesses to adultery or fornication unless it's a very obscure circumstance. And the point of that is to be a sort of a deterrent for the capital punishments that are there there for that. The accusation or the evidential burden for rape is only one witness, and it can be the victim herself. So there is a narration of the Prophet, peace be upon him, where a woman came to him and she was crying. There was lots of people around, and she said, "This has just happened to me. She's just been raped." And her testimony was enough, and she pointed out the guilty party, and justice was administrated. So I think there's been some kind of misinformed ideas about the criteria, and as I mentioned earlier, there were no real substantial features about the Sharia law in its text, in its jurisprudence, that were really brought out by either party. So I don't think that anybody here would have enough information to even say that Sharia law was somehow more unfair than English law, other than what we've told you about today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Could I just clarify one thing that I think might help a lot of people? Are you actually joining in condemnation of what is going on in certain parts of the...
Of course. I do not believe that any Muslim country in the world today enacts or implements the Sharia as it is intended to be implemented. And there are many people who are of this view. And the reasons for that I stated earlier, which is that, you know, it's a declined society. It's post-colonial. People are basically all fighting for their own survival, for their own interest. There's not much law and order. But this is not what an Islamic system or an Islamic ruling would actually look like. And we don't have to go back to ancient times to see that. We only have to go back 100 years.
Right. Thank you. Adrienne, would you like to...
Well, just very briefly, I think that what Sarah has just said says it all. No Muslim country implements Sharia as it is intended. It's no good having an ideal. It's no good looking back at a text, at the Quran, the Hadith. Sarah is quite right. We don't criticise the substance of the laws, although, of course, if... the Quran or the Hadith prescribe capital punishment for adultery. Well, how do you change that? Common law can change. Parliament can change things. But how do you change that? How do you change capital punishment for apostasy? You can't. And that is why it's no good looking at what the law is. You've got to look at what attaches to the law. What are the consequences of the law if you breach the law? You've got to look at how it's implemented. You've got to look at who is implementing it. And it boils down really to one expression. I'm looking straight at the gentleman over there who mentioned it to me the other day, quality control. That's what it's all about, and that is what we're lacking in everything we've just heard, and that's what you've got to hold on to. Who is going to interpret the law? Who is going to create the law insofar as the common law, can evolve? And who is going to select those who do it? And you cannot get away from the fact that the common law system has addressed and deals with those points. Nothing that we've heard tonight from our very learned colleagues has in any way addressed those problems.
Thank you, Adrienne. Now, we now come to the section of seeking any questions from the... audience here. So does anybody have a point they would like to make?
So may I just interject maybe?
We're just doing one.
Oh, just one interruption.
Yes, please.
Hello, my name is Roger Spriggs. I'd just like to ask the proponents of the motion a little bit of clarification. We've heard much discussion about Sharia law and how it's interpreted or practiced in different parts of the world. I'd like to sort of short-circuit that argument and just so I understand a bit more about Islam. I would like you to confirm or say that it's not the case, that the Quran is in Islam is thought to be the actual words of God spoken in Arabic. Is that right?
Yes. It's Arabic. The Quran is in Arabic,
yes,
of course.
But it's still the same language spoken then and spoken now. Yes.
Yes.
All over. Okay. So there's very, compared to the, say, the New Testament, which was probably taken down in Aramaic and translated in Greek and backwards and forwards and eventually Latin and ended up in English, there's very little wriggle room. You can't change anything, really, in the Quran. And I take it that the Sharia law, although there seem to be many versions of it, one thing it doesn't do is contradict what the Word of God says in the Quran. Is that right?
Well, it's derived from the Word of God. So Sharia is based upon the word, that which is related by the Word of God to do with legislation matters.
Okay. So the Quran condones slavery, doesn't it?
I wouldn't say it condones slavery.
It doesn't say you must not have a slave. In fact, it tells you that you mustn't have a Muslim slave, but it implies quite clearly, it tells you how to treat slaves, etc.
Well,
I've got a printout of the number of times slavery is mentioned in the Quran.
Sure, and it attributes righteousness to letting them go.
Yes, but that doesn't say you mustn't have them in the first place.
On this point of slavery, when we think of slavery, we tend to think of the barbaric form of slavery that is historically, you know, pronounced and known, that, you know, black slavery in the States and, you know, colonial history of black slavery. Now, when Islam came about, people had domestic servants. People had helpers in their homes, and people abused them and did not always afford them their rights. Now, what Islam did was to say that these people have rights. You're supposed to basically treat them like employees, and it raised their status, and such that in some states and some Islamic states thereafter, people actually wanted to be servants in a household, because they would be subject to getting the same education, the same access to higher society, the same prospects in life.
Can
so the concept
you?
Of slavery are completely different.
I was interrupting. I just want to finish off with this point. Yeah. Slaves are generally poor people. We've heard much about how Islam looks after poor people. They don't look after slaves. Well, Arabs have been the par excellence slavers of all time.
We're talking about Islam, not Arabs.
They derive their motivation.
Thank you for that.
But one could also argue that there was a point in time where English law not only permitted it, but also actively encouraged companies to go around and buy them in mass. There was a market. They were creating the market for it. So one could indict English law on that.
I think we've covered this point. Any other points, yes? Would you like it?
Yes, my name is Susan Nicholas, and I thank all four of you. I've listened to The Passion, and I've heard The Quiet Calm. One small point I would say is that in nearly every British school now, you will find that it's a non-secular assembly in the mornings, that every religion is accepted, and they're not necessarily Christian assemblies in the morning. And our children are being educated into so many of the faiths, which made it rather strange for me to hear on Radio 4 yesterday some interviews with a lot of Muslim children in this country who did not know and understand the difference between just this Sharia law and our common law, and they toured. Each one of them said they felt that they were being disloyal to their race and creed if they tried to discover anything about the common law. And I found that quite illuminating.
Did you have a question on that, or are you just making a statement?
No, that's what I want to know, is how are the Muslim children in this country taught as much about our faiths and our laws as the British children?
Right.
Well, I mean, this kind of falls into the very much in the remit of just our organization, Muslim Debate Initiative. Why is it called Debate Initiative? The whole point is to actually introduce Muslims and non-Muslims to points of view they've never heard before, and ideas that they were just previously obscure to them, and make it clear and actually give fair time to the to each side to explain their perspective, you know, from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So in the Muslim community, generally speaking, there is an increasingly high literacy of understanding of different laws and law systems. And we'd encourage that, even just for comparative reasons. It's always good to know, it's always good to understand. Of course, if you live in this country, you should know what the laws are so that you don't fall foul of them, of course. That makes a practical sense, of course. But I don't think there is nowhere that within Islam or Sharia or any legal opinion I've ever heard of from Islamic perspective that says that just knowing what the law of a land is, like English law, is disrespectful or being disloyal to your faith. It's very strange.
In fact,
maybe they shouldn't ask the kids.
You're encouraged to know the law of the land because you are encouraged to live by the laws of the land that you live in.
Yeah, maybe you shouldn't get your opinion of Sharia from kids, you know, who are just, they're just children.
Thank you. Well, thank you on that. Yeah, the next question.
I just wanted to clarify, are we talking about a Sharia in a time gone by? And where and when was it practiced in the way that you're discussing, Zara? Question number one, and then I have a follow-up.
Okay, I think I mentioned it a couple of times, but I'll reiterate. So the Sharia is practiced in a state that has all of the infrastructure available to ensure that everything runs properly, because in the Sharia system, the economics is linked to the politics is linked to the social.
I want to know when and where.
Okay, so I can give you the last example. Would have been the Ottoman Caliphate, which was finally abolished in 1924. In the last perhaps 50 years or so, because it was in a state of decline, probably not a good example in the last few years of it, but that began in maybe the 12th or 13th century up until as late as then, and it extended not just in one certain region. It wasn't just Turkey, it extended from parts of Africa to parts of Europe. It was a vast area of land for a long period of time, and it worked in this way where I've given some examples to you earlier today. Women, for example, had the freedom and ability, if they wanted to go out and work. You often found women either being traders themselves or operating businesses by having employees and agents of their own.
I think Zara, are you asking where is it practiced now?
It was partly because I was slightly confused by Abdullah's presentation, which seemed to not be talking about that time and that place, but the current interpretation, elements of the current interpretation now.
I think that was to respond to
practiced in the way you're describing? Which country?
There's no holistic practice of Sharia. What you'll find is the Muslim countries are generally mostly secular countries with secular-based law systems and so on.
Thank you. There's somebody at the back.
Sorry,
so you can carry on.
Thank you. Let's cut straight to the chase. Islam, like communism, are ideologies. And ideologies do not work.
Thank you.
Okay, but then what's liberalism?
Please proceed with your question.
Thank you very much. I'm slightly confused by the actual motion, because as I understand it, both common law is based on judges and their experience of case law. As we've heard from our Muslim friends, that Sharia law is based on the interpretation of professors or teachers of jurisdiction. So isn't the point that it is what we need is a unifying law? No one's suggesting we don't have one or the other in this country. What we're wanting to do is guard against extremism. And it wasn't that long ago that we were told we couldn't have women priests because it wasn't written in the Bible. So isn't it the motion that is slightly wrong in this case? No one's suggesting either or. And as I understand it, Sharia law in this country is only allowed under the jurisdiction or under the law or of the courts anyway. And no, it's not allowed in criminal law.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other? Yes? Gentlemen.
Brian Chandler. I think everybody in the room will make their own judgments as to whether it is ever fair to by whoever has to execute people for sodomy or for apostasy, which is renouncing their own religion. One of the other problems, of course, is whether it is fair to stay within a medieval interpretation. For example, I understand that it is inadmissible to use forensic evidence in Sharia law, and if you try to convince me that is fair to women, I'm afraid you will not do so.
Right.
Can I make a response at least?
Yeah.
I think there's people just say apostasy law and then just walk away, and then it's like that's dealt. I've answered this question. I've made this point. No, allow me to retort. It's not apostasy law, it's better translated as a treason or sedition law. Just changing your mind doesn't merit the death penalty. And you can check this yourself. Go to chapter 4 in the Quran, verses 88 to 91. You'll see your answer where it says, those who do not fight against you, nor offer you, but withdraw from you, offer you peace, God does not give you way against them. So it tells the Muslims that someone who offers you peace, withdraws from you, offers you peace, you don't fight them. But those people who abandon Islam and then they help enemies and they fight physically against you, this is what the verses of the Quran say, chapter 4, 88 to 91. Read it for yourself. It's against sedition and treason. But what we hear from the media is, oh, this is apostasy law and so on, whereas it is clearly not if you look at the actual formulation of it. I mean, I don't know.
Apostasy remains a criminal offense.
Maybe in your personal law, but in Sharia law, it's sedition and treason. And I think maybe not in English law per se, but in the United States, of course, it's still punishable by capital punishment, which is an Anglo-Saxon based law. Okay, technically it's not English law, that's correct. But as for sodomy, again, you misunderstand. The Sharia has no jurisdiction what people do in the privacy of their home. No jurisdiction whatsoever. You can't punish people for what they do in their own privacy. Public lewdness is punishable in English law as well. So you can't do sodomy in public in the UK or fornication or any kind of sex in public, basically. So This is something maybe that the Sharia and English law actually agrees on that one matter.
Thank you, Abdullah. Thank you. Charles, if you...
I just wanted to say that common law, as practiced in this country, actually works by the consent of the people. We all think it's a pretty good way of running the place. Now, you've talked, Zara, about Sharia law and about the fact that today it is not being run in the way that you would want it run in its purest form.
Yeah.
But surely that means that your community, your Muslim community, has actually rejected what you're proposing. Yeah. And they want something different, and that's what they've got today.
No, I don't think the fact that is that, you know, as Abdullah mentioned, the reasons we don't see Sharia in the Muslim world today is because it's simply not a Sharia system. They're secular systems. So when we're rejecting that, we're not rejecting the Sharia system. We're rejecting the secular systems. We're rejecting the secular implementations of different things mixed with a few token bits of Islamic law. So, you know, when we say that's not Sharia, we're saying that is not Sharia. And it's pretty widely held. And in fact, a lot of polls done in the Muslim world during, for example, the Arab Springs, people said that they wanted Islamic law. They wanted Sharia law. They didn't want the systems that they had. They didn't want these systems that they have now, which are no different to what they had before the Arab Spring. And we've talked, a few people have brought up the, you know, how it's the effect of the law. It doesn't matter what it actually says. Well, we brought up a few points about what English law, you know, points of law as it's written. But apparently that wasn't enough to show that, you know, English law is maybe not unfair. So if it's about the effect of the law, then it might be worth noting that one study done found and actually raised in and documented in Hansard found that a man who commits a crime, the same as a woman who commits a crime, the same offence, which has the same penalty stipulated, men are far more likely to be harshly punished than women are. So if that's the effect of the law, then how is that fair? If we're going to talk about the effects of laws rather than what the laws actually say, I think Abdullah and I have brought up a few examples which we haven't actually heard any responses on because we've all just clambered onto Sharia. You know, maybe it would be good to hear some responses to that today as well.
The Muslim governments who have the opportunity to introduce Sharia law in the pure form that you have spoken about are not doing it.
Yeah, they're not. They're declined regimes who are...
Are we voting for Sharia of 100 years ago, of the Ottoman Empire, which we all know from history was... an open society and allowed religious tolerance, etc., and was an intellectual society. Are we voting today on that fairness, or are we voting today on the fairness of what we see of the other side of the Muslim world?
Well, I mean, this was my opening statement. In my opening statement, I very clearly said that the motion today should not be focused on what's happening in the Muslim world because it is not a reflection of the Sharia. And so when we want to talk about the Sharia, we have to talk about what the law actually asks people to do, not what people are doing in the Muslim world today under the guise of it instead.
But Zara, I think I understand the confusion here that we all see these dreadful things going on, as obviously there's some wonderful things as well. So that the I'm worried that you can't point to any countries that you say do adopt.
Do you know why we call it post-colonial? Do you know why we call it post-colonial? Because, I mean, look, just look at what Lord Cromer, the English governor of Egypt, said about the English project for Egypt, that basically the European powers would not tolerate a retrograde Mohammedan government in Egypt, and that the spirit of Western civilization must be forcefully imposed upon the Egyptians. In his book, in his book on Egypt, this is what he said: the Muslims after colonialism never had the choice or the freedom. Now we're dealing with client regimes, puppet rulers who are widely resented by their own governments. The Arabic Spring, what happened after the Arab Spring? All these Islamic groups got voted into power. Every single election saw the success of Islamic group, which then subsequently was deposed, like Morsi. And in Syria, the majority of opposition groups are the Islamic groups, and some of them are being now suppressed by both Syria and America. I don't agree with some of the more wackier factions, which could be argued were encouraged to grow by Assad. But what we're seeing is that the Muslim world wants an Islamic regime, an Islamic state. They're being denied it, and then what's springing out of this suppression are the really wacky elements who are so reactionary and so angered by all the torture and the suppression that they are now become the mirror opposite of the torture and the suppression that they've faced. And this is the situation you see in the Muslim world. When the Muslim world can reach its liberation to re-establish a system that was 1,400 years from the Umayyad Caliphates, from the Prophet Muhammad, the Umayyad Caliphate, the Abbasid Caliphate, and the Ottoman Caliphate, when we see that system established, then we can, which is an example of Sharia, then we can have a discussion. Unfortunately, we're not allowed to establish an example which we can now debate today as time, which is current, unfortunately.
Thank you very much, Abdullah.
Is it not the case that the most hardline Sharia country is Saudi Arabia? And forgive me, but I don't think Saudi Arabia has ever been colonized.
Well, I mean, who supported the Saud faction against the Ottomans? Read the books of Lawrence of Arabia. You'll find a lot of support for the Saud faction, guns, money to actually put him into power on condition that he be an extension of British foreign policy in the region, and until he was gazumped by the Americans, of course, the dynasty that is. So we didn't. These people are client regimes, and if you speak to the average Muslim on the streets, they too hate their rulers, and the current issue amongst the Muslim world, how do we achieve a liberation and autonomy for ourselves?
Thank you,
Dola. I think you might be right about Saudi up to a point, but in fact, wasn't it the Saudis who displaced our man and took it all over in the late 20s? So we were trying to put the place down, and in fact, he was hoofed out by a Saudi, who then the Saudi family as it is now, and that's where it all.
Britain supports the stronger dog in the two, so it just redirected Sharif Hussein to Jordan. They tried Syria, didn't work because the French didn't like him there, so he got redirected to Iraq. That's where he'd be good for his employment job as a British proxy. And of course the Saudi made a deal with Britain until obviously the US took over.
Thank you.
British puppets.
Very impressive erudition. Thank you very much, everyone. I'm struggling a bit with geography here because if we are asked to debate in theory whether Sharia law is better than common law, we are sort of extracting it because neither is trying to impose their system on another geography. We're talking about an intellectual debate here, essentially, as I understand. So if we take away geography, if there's any point to this debate, it's what can happen in the future. We've got a multicultural world. We've got huge sections of each other's populations working in each other's countries, globalization and all the rest of it. That is a given. What I'd like to ask the speakers, and I'm afraid I have less familiarity with Islam than I do perhaps with our common law, is which elements of the menu of punishments are in your vision of the going back to good old days of Sharia law, which elements of the punishment menu should have a place in the present or the future? We're talking about capital punishment, how that's administered, whether by staining or beheading. We're talking about amputations, we're talking about mutilation, we're talking about public floggings. I only asked the question, not out of criticism. I've heard your defences and your deploring how it is practiced, but actions speak louder than words. You're defending the words. What actions should be in place on the punishment side, please?
Can that question be applied also to the other side? If you're going to look talk retrospective, then what sort of punishments coming back from common law 100 or so years ago would the team have?
Who would like to answer that?
I'm not talking that's kind of like, if you want to know what the current ideal Sharia law is now.
The difficulty of that question, I don't think that the host will give me the amount of time to go through all the different points and the nuances. Right. But I'll try. First and foremost, just the concept of, okay, this debate is not about whether England should be under Sharia or not. If that's the case, if that was the debate, I would be on the side saying, well, this is a non-Muslim country. It's, you know, full of people who believe in the English law. It's under English law. There's no debate here, no discussion. Yeah, yeah, of course. Take the geography out. So today we're just really debating in abstract these law systems. Of course, English law is linked to it's always changing. So we have to anchor it to its current implementation, unless you want to debate maybe which is fairer, English law 100 years ago or Sharia. But on the actual issue of the capital punishments and so on, my argument is the same as John Stuart Mill's argument. He argued that locking someone up in prison for the rest of their life is more inhumane and grotesque than giving them a like-for-like punishment for if they committed murder, they get subject to capital punishment. And their suffering ends with the delivery of the capital punishment, obviously provided that the evidence is very rigorous. So John Stuart Mill, great British intellectual, I agree with that argument. It's the same as the Sharia position. We don't lock people in human zoos for the rest of their life with no hope of escape, and then turn them into almost like animals in these with no hope of any life outside it. In terms of the punishment system, what we're advocating is no different to, I said, what was implemented at the time of the Prophet Muhammad and onwards. So we're not abrogating or changing any of the laws. But what I would like to have more time to explain is, what are the contexts of these laws? How are they applied to whom? What is the evidence? What is the purpose? And of course, the issue is that they are applied upon people who actually consent to them by being Muslim and establishing an Islamic state, which the leader is elected by the people to establish the law. It is a law by consent. So I don't have much time to go through all the other laws. Maybe you want to ask me individually, then we can have a loophole where the host wants to prevent me from answering, but I'm happy to go through them one by one if I have time.
Honor killings?
That's not part of Islam at all. That's a pre-Islamic cultural practice. One could argue that honor killings exist in any society. If even what you call crimes of passion in the West is just a Western version of honor killings, but they're all equally wrong.
Thank you. Very revealing.
Well, I think we're now reaching the point where I'd like to draw to a conclusion and thank our speakers very much indeed. It's a lot of food for thought, and I'm sure we shall deliberate for a long time. But you do actually have to put a tick on your papers. And while that is being counted, Ian, I think you would like to say a few words. So can I pass the...
Well, I'd just show. I'd just like to say thank you all very much for coming on behalf of the Bewley Chapter of the British Heart Foundation. Organising this event has been our Commander-in-Chief, Sarah Steele, the Marling Roberts and Bentley Buckles, our double-barrelled powerhouses, Jill and I, who kind of swan around the periphery, being useful as we can.
Well, we now come to the result, and actually it's very interesting because the number of people who are following the debate agree with the motion has doubled, which I think is a great accolade to you, and well done on that. I think that the figures actually are in it before the debate started, 54, is that people or percent? You think? It was 54 people were against the motion and 7 were for it, and afterwards 15 were for the motion and 46 against. It was a difficult task, and we're very grateful for you coming. Although nobody asked you many questions, Adriana, we're very grateful to you for being here this evening and helping with the debate. That's right.
We've got a reduced majority.
Yeah. I know.